Welcome to The Mystic and the Skeptic, the show that asks the tough questions and explores different alternatives to today's pressing issues, theories, or enigmas.
We're here at the 40th Annual Texas Hispanic Genealogical and Historical Conference. The tagline is Honoring Our Ancestors, a 500-year journey back to Hernán Cortés. We are in Dallas, and I will be speaking later during the conference. But I'm going to butcher your name, so if you could tell us your name and why you're here.
My name is Shelley Talalai Dardashti, and I'm one of the speakers at the conference.
Tell us, you have an extensive resume, but if you tell us, why have you made your life's work to discuss DNA and the history of, is it only Latinos or anybody who is researching their DNA?
Well, we always knew, we know that our family was Sephardic that wound up in Belarus. We know that we left in 1398. I have archival documents from 1353 through 1398 from the town of Lleida in Catalonia, which is about 140 kilometers northwest of Barcelona. And I got into the Sephardic end of genealogy before I even knew anything about this. I was at a music camp at the University of Massachusetts when I was in junior high school. That was A.D. after dinosaurs, or actually B.D. before dinosaurs. And the first book I bought, I discovered the university bookstore. And I'm a book person. And I discovered a Judaica section that was bigger than my parents' house. And the first book that I ever bought at camp that year was Cecil Roth's History of the Marranos. Of course, a term we don't use today because it's offensive and pejorative. We use the word converso, we use the name neonicene. There are other words, but we don't use the M word. But that's literally what got me started. I've been doing research on Sephardic history and Sephardic genealogy basically since junior high school.
And for our audience that does not know the terms, Sephardic is the Jews of Spain and Portugal, or the Iberian Peninsula, and your family comes from Iran, so tell us tell us how your family migrated during the expulsion, where did they go to, and where have you lived, and how you ended up in America learning about your past.
Sure. My middle name, the Talalai that I use, the name in Spain was Talaya, and it's most of the records that we have found in the town of Lleida, which I mentioned, in Catalonia. Those were most of our records are found. Some of them were in the Crown Archives of Aragon and Barcelona. But I was very fortunate in that my researcher in Spain lives in Barcelona and comes from the town of Lleida. So sometimes things work in mysterious ways and you make the right connections. So that's how I have those records. But my husband, my late husband, was Persian. And even in Iran, there was a small group of Iberian Sephardim that settled in the town of Kashan in the 1600s. But that's totally separate. I'm also the genealogist for my husband's Persian family. But our family, from what we know, what we've been able to trace, is that we, in 1391, there were terrible, it was a difficult time all over Spain. Most of the Jewish communities were destroyed. People were massacred. They had the same choice, convert or be killed. And some of the communities came back, others did not. Lleida had a very difficult time. They really never came back. So we know we left by 1398 because one of our records is a notice of people that owe taxes, and they sent it to two of our family members, and we said, nah, we're out of here. We've been out of there for a while. And from what we know, we crossed the Pyrenees, that's into southern France, which actually was known as French Catalonia because they spoke Catalan in that section of France around Perpignan. And we went from France to Germany to Poland to Lithuania to Belarus. And that's where we were from those mid-1600s. And we have records across, around there. There are still families with our original name in southern France around Perpignan. There are some marriage records from Antwerp with the same name. And it's been a fascinating journey. But we know that there were many Sephardim that went into Eastern Europe, and we're finding remnants of them all the time.
So if you can share with us the main points of your presentation, and just to bring up something personal. So my niece had a DNA test, and she has family from Bolivia, so 50% of it is indigenous people from Bolivia. And then us, it came out as 48% Spanish Portuguese, but then 2% Ashkenazi Jew. So is that some of the things that you encounter, and then how do you build a case from that?
Okay. The main thing is that you have to test judiciously and then transfer those results everywhere possible. The two companies that do the best at Sephardic and also Mizrahi, which would be the Jews of West Asia and the East, that covers Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, India, even into China, would be MyHeritage.com and FamilyTreeDNA. If you test at Ancestry, it'll say everybody's Ashkenazi, basically with 23andMe. They're very Ashkenazi-centered. They really don't have the reference populations. FamilyTreeDNA was the first company in DNA for consumer genealogy. And they have a very large base of Jewish testees. And there are many specialized projects and groups on FamilyTreeDNA as well. MyHeritage is the only one that has done its own founder population testing, very extensive testing in specific Jewish communities. It's a global company, but it's based in Israel, so they have vested interests in certain communities. And they tested the five ethnicities that we can offer that MyHeritage offers are Ashkenazi, Sephardic North Africa, Mizrahi, Iran, Iraq, Yemenite, and Ethiopian. And so in addition to the commercially, academically available population reference studies, we also did this founder population study, which enables us to break down that Jewish component much better. So no matter where you test, if you test at Ancestry, if you test at 23andMe, you should always upload to MyHeritage.com and to FamilyTreeDNA to get a much better view, a much better perspective using different population reference databases and different ways of testing and searching. And, of course, to find more people, because you don't know where your unknown relatives have tested. So you really have to fish in all the ponds.
I was asked during my last presentation, what do you think about DNA? And I was speaking from a religious standpoint, mm-hmm. that you can't really prove someone's religion from their DNA. So how would you respond to that if it comes out negative?
Okay. Well, one of the projects that I co-founded is the Iberian Ashkenaz Project at FamilyTreeDNA. We have thousands of participants in it. And we always tell people, science can't prove metaphysics or religion. On the other hand, when you test and most of the people you match, exact or very close, if they claim that they are Jewish, they have Jewish background, you can make certain assumptions. If most of the people that you match claim that they're totally something else and they deny is the wrong word, but they absolutely don't match, they're from totally different areas geographically, and most of them are not Jewish in any way, you can make an assumption there too. So with the Iberian Ashkenaz Project, we can claim that people are likely Sephardic, unlikely Sephardic, require more testing. We can break it down into five or six different categories. But you're absolutely right. Your DNA is not going to show little Jewish stars on your blood cells. We know that for sure. And claiming that DNA can prove religion is a problem. It is. For me, as a genetic genealogist or a genealogist that deals a lot with genetics, I find that very troubling when that's discussed. I can tell you that if you match, you have 100 exact matches and they're all Jewish, that tells me something. If you have 100 exact matches and none of them are, that also tells me something. But I'm not going to make the... I'll tell you that, okay, likely Sephardic or not Sephardic, right? But on the other hand, we know what happened over history. We know Jews stayed Jews. Jews changed religions. Jews changed their names depending on what was going on in what country. But it's troubling when DNA, when they try to use DNA to prove religion. I find that troubling because I know in the microscope you're not going to see where the church starts. And actually that's why some people are against it from a religious standpoint, because they will say, well, how do you prove that? The one case in particular is the fact that we know in Iran there were certain cases where all the Kohanim in a village or a town were killed or died of illness or killed or whatever happened. And Jewish law states that if you do not have a Kohen to appoint, because you need a Kohen to do certain things, you must have one. And that people were appointed to be the Kohen. And this is in Jewish halakha, we're allowed to do that. The problem is that no one remembers when it happened. We think it happened two times. No one's really sure of it. And when we wanted to do extensive testing among the Persian community in Israel, we had some problems there because people in the community knew about this. And one would assume that another Kohen might have been appointed. One would assume if there weren't any Kohens, the next best thing would be a Levite. If there were no Levites, you would just appoint a regular old Israelite. And someone had to be appointed to do this. So we know today, in the past we thought it was one genetic line for Kohanim, but now it's two or three. We know in the beginning that we thought there was one Levite line, there's now four, and there may be more. So we know things happened in Jewish history that are not that cut and dried. Things happened. And if someone tests who was perhaps a descendant of one of those families that wasn't a Kohen, who was appointed to become the Kohen for a certain geographical area. So their DNA is not going to show the modal signature, which is a three-marker signal coding. And this actually shows on the Y DNA, the male, direct male Y DNA tested family tree DNA. There are three markers. If you have that, that's considered the Cohen modal signature. If you don't have that, but your family still has the oral tradition of being a Cohen family, then you really have to start looking at things. But these things could have happened thousands of years ago. The Y DNA, direct male, father to son to son to son to son, goes back thousands of years. If there was one line, it would be really simple. It would be a direct line from Aaron. But now there's four lines. And there are Kohanim who believe they are Kohanim because it's a very strong oral tradition with observances connected and restrictions applied that don't have it. So again, this is another problem of science and metaphysics. It's a problem. I find it to be problematic, and I know why they have the distances or the differences between these lines. So eventually we will learn a lot more. Someone will invent a time machine, and we'll go back and check it out. That's what I'm waiting for. That will be the next best thing to DNA. It will be a time machine.
So what is the conversation with your presentation? What are the main points that you talk about? And you mentioned that you've had a really positive review from the audience. So tell us, what did you discuss today?
Well, basically what I started off with, it's a really interesting group, and it's a fascinating group of people that are attending this conference, and I give Hogar really great, great, great credits. It's been a wonderful conference with really great speakers. So because I know the population of the conference, and it's confusing because many people don't have no idea that they have anything like this in their background until they get a DNA test. But there are a lot of ins and outs to this. So I basically started by talking about the three major divisions today in the Jewish world. You have Sephardic, you have Mizrahi, you have Ashkenazi. Then you have other people that don't neatly fit in those little pigeonholes. And we discussed areas where all three populations live together at the same time, side by side, and that we would really have to be really naive to think that if they lived together for centuries, that no genetic material was passed around, so to speak. We went into various DNA projects that were investigating these things. We went into one section that I really enjoy doing, and it's extremely important, because I live in New Mexico. And in northern New Mexico, a large majority of all the families that came in 1598 in the early 1600s were all converso families, Jewish background, Jewish ancestry, Jewish heritage. Some today still deny it. Some don't know. Some families know exactly who they are and what they do. But BRCA1, breast cancer, has decimated northern New Mexico. And we got into this because everywhere we went, they kept saying Ashkenazi women from Eastern Europe should be tested. But it's not Ashkenazi. The very aggressive mutation is the shorthand for it is 185 delete. Very aggressive. Same exact one that most Ashkenazi women have, if they have it. Very aggressive form. It's the same exact mutation that's found in northern New Mexico. So it's not just an Ashkenazi issue. And it's not just a woman's issue, because men can also have the BRCA1 mutation. They may develop testicular cancer, prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer, a lot of other things. They may not develop anything, but they may pass it on to their sons and daughters. So it's not just a woman's issue, it's also a men's issue, and it's not only an Ashkenazi issue, it is a Jewish issue. And because we felt so strongly about this, the Jewish Genealogical Society of New Mexico and Casa Sefarad New Mexico run an annual spring Jewish Genetics Conference in Albuquerque. This year it's at the end of April. And we have the top genetic oncologist in town, Dr. Victor Vigil, speaking. We have the top women's breast surgeon, Dr. Linda Smith. We have people from imaging. And we have a lot of other speakers that are there. And not only do we talk about BRCA1 and why it's in northern New Mexico, but there are a lot of other genetic conditions as well that are found in New Mexico among this population. And the only other people who have some of these conditions are some isolated converso population in Guatemala. And the organization that is doing the most research on this is the Avoteno Jewish Heritage Project, which is headed by Adam Brown. He's the manager of this project. We have 6,000 people tested already. We're testing every Jewish community, everywhere. And what they've discovered in the past, it's been around for a number of years, the project, that when we look at the Ashkenazi results, there are only 80 specific lineages. But when we talk about Sephardic, it's 400 lineages, which it's a much more diverse community, and there are many conditions that are found in that community that are found only in other basically very isolated communities with the same mutations. There are some neurological conditions, there are some skin diseases. So we do all of that as part of this, and I work with them. I'm like a representative in the New Mexico community. But there are other people, like in Seattle, my cousin Ike Azos is a retired chazan up there in Seattle. And when we had the International Association of Jewish Genealogical Societies up there, Adam asked him to get some people tested, and he said, "Oh, I know where they are. They're playing golf on Thursday morning. Give me the kits. I'll go get them before they eat breakfast." And he ran out there. He's so excited to be part of this. And he got many people in the Sephardic Seattle community to participate. And to those of your listeners, it's very easy to contact Adam and to ask if your name or names are in the group already, and if they have an interest, they can arrange for the testing. Because it is an academic group. It's an academic study. And I will give you, I'll have those. I always have to look it up because I don't want to get it wrong. And then we can announce that at the end email. They can contact Adam through those emails.
So we talked about one of the fears of having your DNA tested is what are people going to do with it. And what was the name of the young lady where they took her DNA and then they started making vaccines out of it? She was African-American.
Oh, from down south. I read the book and I can't think of her name. Begins with an L. That was a long time ago, and that changed many procedures once that became known. Some of the DNA services now have arrangements with pharmaceutical companies, with other research, but in almost all the cases that I know, it's either an opt-in or an opt-out. Most people never read the terms of service for the organizations that they belong to. It's a really good thing to read the terms of service. If you're worried about that, you can opt out or opt in, depending on how that website is set up. And if you're concerned about that, you can remove yourself from that particular testing. And that's an important thing to do if you're concerned about it. On the other hand, it's a really big thing now. People are doing it to solve crimes, old crimes. C.C. Moore, who's a fantastic genetic genealogist in California, she works with that. She works with a company called Parabon that uses DNA to find criminals. Cold cases. There was just one solved, 100-year-old cold case that was solved using DNA. So what you're doing is weighing the advantages to the disadvantages. If you can use DNA to solve a terrible crime, is that worth it? Is it not worth it? But this is a decision that every person has to make on their own and read up on it. But if you don't want to do it, each of the companies that offers this kind of connection or that's developing these connections, they offer an opt-in or an opt-out. You just have to read the terms of service and learn how to do it. So if you don't want to do that, you can opt out of it. Just have to read it and know how to do it, learn how to do it.
How would you respond to people that say that researching your genealogy has to do with people not having an identity and wanting to build an identity, and also that it goes against democratic values of all of us just being one people, and that the more tribal we are, the more divided we are?
That is a good question. I think who we are today depends on who our ancestors were. I think we have such a diverse background in each of us that all these little pieces add up to who we are today. I think it can be very empowering. I think it connects people to their families, to their origins. I don't like to see it involved in politics, and I'm not going to get into it on this recording. And I have a lot of problems with that. But for those who have tested, I would think the majority of people are feeling a connection to their ancestors, a connection to what the people before them went through, and how they can build on the advantages to that and the good things out of that. Anyone can build on bad things, but I think it's a much more empowering thing to build on who we were, who our ancestors were, how they overcame hardships and all kinds of problems and the things that they lived through, and they still made it, and we're here because of that. That's something to be considered. That's a real advantage. I don't like to see it being broken down into political areas. I think that's a real problem. But the positive advantages to this, I find are much more overpowering than the disadvantages.
Do you see there's problems with the modern Jewish community with losing their numbers either to assimilation or secularism? Do you see that some people in the community are becoming a little more entrenched, and that using DNA to show that maybe there's more Jews in the world than they thought might be threatening some of their institutions or their own sense of self? Do you see that, and is that one of the concerns that comes up sometimes with people who find out about their Sephardic or Spanish-Portuguese background not being accepted into the greater Jewish community?
We find across the board that that is a problem in the United States. What we tried to do at Casa Sephardic in Albuquerque is an education program. It's not involved at all with proselytizing. It's based on education and cultural history. Nobody goes out and proselytizes, but we feel everybody should know who they are, where they come from, in whatever method is available and what they're interested in. It's learning history. The DNA is fascinating because for some people, that's the first inkling. That's the first hint that they've ever heard that they might be something other than what they grew up as. I think that some Jewish institutions are rather threatened by that. I have several friends who have returned, and in different communities. And one thing we always say to everybody, if we know they belong to a congregation, is always pay attention to who's sitting in the back row and make them feel welcome, because you never know who's going to be the next leader of your community. People are afraid. Sometimes people will make that. We've had cases of this in several states, even in Mexico, where someone who just found out that they have this connection, or perhaps a loved one on their deathbed, told them they're Jewish, and they go, like, what do I do about it now? And they make a very tentative approach, and they call a synagogue. Most of the time, they'll get someone who's not Jewish, a secretary, a receptionist, and they'll say, oh, there's no such thing as a Hispanic Jew. And they go away because it took all their courage they've been building on for a year to make that one phone call, and someone just shoots them down and they never come back. It's a matter of pride. It's a matter of acceptance. Those who persevere may still be sitting in the back row because the rabbis don't know they're there. Nobody in the community knows they're there. They just know, who are those people? Some may look just like them. Some may not look like them. We have people from every race and every background that's interested in this. And when people finally are brave enough to make that connection, to call somebody, it's a very courageous thing to do. And it's something I think that Jewish institutions, the normative Jewish institutions today, need to think about. The community is changing. It can change. And the more interesting, diverse people that you bring in, that's the new blood is good for every organization and for every community. To be welcoming, to welcome a stranger, is a very, very important Jewish piece of philosophy. And it's a requirement. If you see someone that's new, you must speak to them. You must welcome them. You just don't avoid them because, well, who are those people? We don't know who they are. We don't look like them. And they don't look like us. What are we going to do about that? And they're ignored. And again, that's that matter. If someone is courageous enough to reach out, they need to be addressed. They need to be welcomed. We're very fortunate in New Mexico is that we have Casa Sephardic, which has begun over 20 years ago. And it was based at Nahalat Shalom, which is a renewal synagogue. It was the only one that opened their doors at that time when I was connected, when the project started. Now we're expanding. And we just had meetings with people at federation levels and other levels, and there's a lot of things we're going to be doing to fix this. And it depends on actually the personalities that head up places like federation. Depends on the individual rabbis and the synagogues in the community. Sometimes you need to go speak to them personally and discuss things with them. And this is happening everywhere across America and in other countries as well. And the same kind of prejudices, unfortunately, is still there in many countries. We're not even going to address the problem in Monterrey, New Mexico right now because we know exactly what it is. There are many families that are studying and the community does not welcome them. It's quite the opposite. And this happens in a lot of places. So there's a lot that we want to do in the future. And it involves getting communities together and seeing what the problem is and welcoming people. We all know that during the Inquisition, before and after, and at other times during history, a very long history, is that we lost people by the thousands. We lost thousands of families. Today, people come back one by one. And many times their families are not with them. They're actively against them doing this, rocking the boat, and other terms that we can't use on there. But it involves a lot of talking to people and giving them history and explaining things and saying there has to be a way to get along. This is the future. And it's going to be bad on one side, but there's all these new people that want to come in. And there has to be an open door. There has to be a welcoming of the people that aren't exactly like that established congregation. And people all have to work together to make this a better situation.
Tell us about the law of return of Spain, because when some of us heard about it, it's easy to be cynical, especially since in the original requirements, I don't know if they changed. So these are the Spanish country decided that since they felt culpable for what happened 500 years ago, they were willing to take back descendants of Jews who were exiled. But then in the requirements said that you had to somehow prove or be a member of a congregation for them to take the case seriously. What has been your experience, and how do you help people be able to apply for citizenship of Spain?
Well, Spanish citizenship program is over, unless they're having elections in Spain on November 10th. And they may extend it. We don't know. There's no government in Spain right now, so we can only work on what we know. In the beginning, the law did not say you had to be a practicing Jew today. You could be a descendant of conversos. Many descendants of conversos have applied. In the beginning, you could just do a name report towards the, even though that's all the law requires. And then they kind of switched it. No, you really need a big genealogy. It has to be a really good genealogy. And they kept switching deadlines, and they kept changing things. We know that for instance, if your family wound up from Spain, wound up in the Ottoman Empire, in Greek or in Turkey, there were very few problems that you would face. Jewish Federation of New Mexico is giving a certificate of Sephardic heritage. Orva Shalom in Atlanta was doing that. Then, of course, there was the FCJE, the Federation of Jewish Communities in Spain, in Madrid. So a number of organizations that were providing Sephardic heritage certificates, some with more stringent rules. The law was written a certain way, and some organizations decided to interpret it in different ways. So that's where some of the problems came from. But in New Mexico, we're extremely fortunate is that all the original families are extremely well, beautifully documented. The problem is going back to finding which one of those ancestors was truly Jewish. And we have excellent genealogists that can do that as well. So we've been very lucky in a lot of cases. And this was more of a problem in New Mexico because overwhelmingly in New Mexico, it's descendants of conversos. Because you couldn't come here as an open Jew in 1598. You had to come as an old Christian, unless you got in. Once in a while, they would change the law and say, okay, new Christians can come. Most of the time, it was only old Christians could come. So they had to travel literally on forged documents to get to the New World. We know that by 1630, conversos were living in every single place in the Spanish colonial empire. This is documented. We know that thousands of people everywhere. But it's been interesting. We were getting like 100 phone calls a day at the Spanish Citizenship Project in Albuquerque. I think that since the deadline has passed, people have until December 31st to upload all their documents, including their genealogy. They did give that deadline. And then until the end of 2020 to take the tests. One of the tests is a simple thing. You get results back very quickly. The DELE test is a language test involving writing and oral comprehension. It's a much more difficult exam. And because it's more subjective, It takes sometimes 3 to 4 months for the results to come back. So they had to extend it until the end of 2020 because people couldn't get seats for the exams, and that was a real problem. That was a huge problem. I think that we're going to be going over to helping people with their Portuguese citizenship in a short time in the future. And in some ways it's easier, in some ways it's harder. You don't have to go there to sign with the notario. You don't have to take a language test. But the genealogical proof has to be really good. So that's going to call on more genealogists. And it's, you don't have to be connected to Portugal. The way the Portuguese law is written is that you can be an Iberian, a descendant of Iberian Sephardim. So it doesn't say you have to be, have to show the Portuguese connection. It's written in a looser way. There right now there are two centers, one in Porto, one in Lisbon. And I always get them mixed up. So check it out online. It's CI Lisboa.org. And that's all the information is online there. For one of them, they really want you to be a practicing Jew today. And for one of them, they will accept conversion facilities. So it has to be checked out because literally there are two cities are doing two different things. But it needs, and if I think if we start doing that, we'll have all the information. So if anybody is interested on that, they can always go to Sephardic, Sephardic certificate.org. That's the Jewish Federation of New Mexico Citizenship Committee. And right now it still says Sephardic certificate, so that'll be easy to switch over from Spain. But all the information that was required for Spain is there. And eventually, I believe that eventually the Portuguese will be there as well. So we'll have all the information in one place.
So our show broadcasts in Nashville, but is recorded in Houston, and we're here in Dallas. You mentioned Monterrey. There's a lot of people from Monterrey in Houston and in Dallas and McAllen, San Antonio. What's happening over there? I know of people who are connected with Breslev Noahidism who have a group in the outskirts of Monterrey. And there was a picture of them, and it was weird because the Noahides usually don't keep the mitzvot, the Jewish commandments. But there was one of the members was wearing tzitzit, was wearing the tassels worn by religious Jews. So what have you heard of Monterrey? And I visited Monterrey 10 years ago and went to the Ashkenazi synagogue. You needed an invitation, and you needed to pass through security. They're connected to the Israeli consulate. So it was very difficult to participate. What has it been like for people who find out about this in Mexico? And I build a case that Mexico is one of the most anti-Semitic countries in the world. And anybody who shares about having Jewish ancestry, it's almost like a social suicide. So what has been the response from the Jewish community in Latin America, especially since in Mexico City, a lot of the Syrian Jews don't even accept converts, and they have other more stringent rules. So what has it been like for... What people don't know is that a lot of the Jews in Latin America came during the Nazi persecution, and that's one of the reasons they're closed, because they've been through a lot. So what about people who find out about their converso background?
That's really interesting. We know that... Well, from Monterrey, we know that the people who settled Monterrey were conversos. I mean, everybody knows that. So if somebody comes up and says... We're from Monterrey, and these are our names. And there were three people today, I even told them. I said, you're from Monterrey, and these are the names you're giving me. You don't need to do a DNA test. We know who you are and what you are. But we know that there's a problem, number one, with the Ashkenazi community. We also know that particularly among descendants of conversos, the feelings against them are even worse sometimes in the Sephardic community. The Sephardic community will say, we left and we stayed Jewish. And the other people will say, so we converted, we were forced to convert, and we're alive and we're here. Both of these are, they're valid. Both of them are valid. But it's a real problem. I mean, I've heard that from many people in Monterey. I know people who live in Monterey. They can't go unless they cannot go to the mainstream synagogue without someone who's already known there in that community, in that synagogue. And they go with them. They couldn't go alone, even though they know the person. So there's a problem with the Ashkenazi communities in Latin America. Even in America, there's a problem with the Sephardic synagogues against people that are newly discovering their roots with a desire to come back and become really good Jews. And there is a problem. And I think it's education. And I think it's sitting down and talking. And I think it's coming to the realization that there's a lot of different flavors of Judaism, and people have diverse backgrounds. And today, if you want to be a Jew, if you really want to be a Jew, and you're studying, and you're doing, you're learning, and you're doing all the right things, and then you want to go to a synagogue and the door slammed in your face, so how does that make you feel as the stranger, as the other? I think there's fear maybe on one side. Those people don't look like us. Who are they? There needs to be more cooperation, how we do it. We're hoping it changes in the future. But what you mentioned is a reality. We know that's a reality all over Central and South America. We know that. I mean, we went to Guadalajara 10 years ago. It was more than that, maybe 20 years ago. And we stayed in a beautiful home that was became a hotel. It was a colonial house. And I noticed the name. It was the architect, the Levy architect, and said, oh, yeah, gee, we're here for Shabbat. Let's go for services. And so I asked the girl at the front desk, how do we do that? She said, I have to call Dr. Levy. And okay, so Dr. Levy got on the phone and said, well, what synagogue do you belong to in America? And who's the rabbi? And what do you do? And all that stuff. And so, okay, we got a pass to go, and we had to get through the guys with the machine guns outside. Once we were in, it was wonderful. It was just like being in Valley Beth Shalom, Mendocino, California. And I understand why there are those safeguards also. We all understand why there are safeguards. And it is a matter of security. But we're coming like American, you know, American Jews. Like, why do we have to go through this? And once we got in, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful congregation. We're still in contact with people we met there like 20 years ago. But again, there's always this lingering fear or just being uncomfortable with others, using the psychological and sociological term. And people just need to sit down and talk to each other. It's the not having contact and not being able to talk to each other in a safe environment causes some of this stuff. They don't know anybody. They don't want to know anybody. If you sat down and ate with somebody in your house, in their house, you would feel different about them, hopefully. You know, you have to make contact somehow in a way that's okay for both groups, and to avoid or lessen that fear of the stranger. And instead go back to really Jewish basic values and welcoming the stranger.
And we've done shows about the insecurity in the Jewish world nowadays with multiple shootings and things happening. So that's why there's been more safeguards when it comes down to attending services or being part of the Jewish community. In your presentations, when people come up to you and say, well, you've opened my eyes, you've helped me realize things, what's the next step for people to get involved in the Jewish community and to participate in Jewish life? Because I've met also a lot of people who say, oh yeah, of course I'm Jewish, but I'm an evangelical Christian, or I'm so happy to be Catholic. Is there, I know Stanley Hortz once said that scholars or academics should not discriminate, that whatever path people take is up to them. But is there also like a litmus test for what someone who's reclaimed their Jewish ancestry, like what do they have to do to prove themselves? And I don't believe in people apologizing or trying to feel bad for whatever happened in the past, but is there a path, like you mentioned return, what have you experienced with these returns, and are they different depending on the community, and has there also been a pushback for conversion and complete making sure that the person is within the right legal system within Judaism, or is there more leniency in what you've seen?
Well, I think in the beginning, when certain denominations started talking about the return, the right of return, I think the basic thing we have to understand is that many of the conversion descendants, their ancestors were forced to convert, to ask them to convert again which has a really insulting and pejorative connection, just semantically. But to ask somebody who was forced to convert and watched ancestors being burned, and ask them to convert again when all they want to do is return to their faith of their ancestors. Procedure in almost all denominations. It's the same exact thing. A conversion is a return. A return is a conversion. You have to study. You have to learn. You have to do a mikvah. You have to be circumcised or go through Brit Dam. You have to study. And you have to do all the same things. It's the semantics of it. To tell someone they have to convert when they've gone through the trauma of forcibly being converted, and now you have to convert again, that is something that I don't think makes anybody happy. In New Mexico, we've done quite a few rites of return. My friend Maria, who you met, my colleague, she did a rite of return 20 years. Her original study was with Rabbi Joseph Black, in the Reform event. It's the same exact thing. Studying and learning and mikvah and everything that's required for the conversion. Active involvement in the Jewish community. She runs almost everything in Albuquerque now. She is amazing. She is out. She's there. And she's doing amazing work in so many different areas. It's really something that has to be considered for the future. I think it involves education of rabbis in all denominations. Like in New Mexico, we have people that never heard, what's a converso? They don't understand. They don't even understand what a Sephardic person is, because most of them are all Ashkenazi. So what do you do when someone comes? Eventually, I mean, our rabbis know already, because we've done a pretty good job of educating. And now the director of Casa Sephardot in New Mexico is Rabbi Jordi Gendre Molina, who is the first Spanish-born rabbi to be ordained since the Inquisition. He is the head of Casa Sephardot now in New Mexico. And so we have really good plans for the future and how we want to organize this and have resources for people to go to. There'll be an online presence in different ways. There are a lot of different things we're discussing at this point for the future. But we know that it takes both sides to get along, for sure. And it involves trying to get people who are really very proud and very courageous and making a first step and then are brushed off. It's very hard to get them to go back again. There's one, I can't even talk about one case we just had. One woman who spoke to a secretary or receptionist that wasn't Jewish and was basically told, you don't belong here. And now she's in another congregation where she's perfectly happy because they knew who she was. But this is a problem across the board. It involves not only a rabbi, not only a chazan, a cantor. It involves the boards of directors who may be fearful of very stable, organized Ashkenazi congregation. And all of a sudden you get a bunch of people in there who you're not sure who they are. I remember exactly after the Persian Revolution, we came back from Iran, and literally synagogues in L.A. were mobbed by Persian Jews who did not have the history of belonging to a congregation and paying dues. We had problems at a major congregation that had an excellent day school where the American parents wanted to take their kids out because they didn't want their children going to Jewish day school with immigrants. This is a long time ago. This is 1978, 1979. There were cases where the Persians had dinner at home because Persians are very family-oriented. You have dinner at home, and then you go to the synagogue. And people would say, oh, they came to eat our cookies. Like, believe me, they had better cookies at home. They don't have to come here to eat your cookies. The fact that they came. And in the morning, they would bring all the kids. There would be strollers and baby carriages and little kids running around. And I mean, the older people, because it was an older congregation, very stable. And the board was saying, what is going on here? And the rabbi made a very impassioned plea on Shabbat morning. He said, this is the future of Judaism. These are our children. These are the kids that are going to grow up and do what I'm doing. You know, this is what we need to do. We need to welcome people. And it took, he was a very forceful, very well-known figure. And he shamed them into stopping the grumbling and the whining about all these new funny people with all these kids that were invading our synagogue. And it worked out fine. It worked out really well. But it took a lot. It took a lot, but it worked out. And it's the same kind of thing. It's the same kind of education on both sides and getting people together to discuss things, sit down and talk and learn about each other.
I had read an article, a very liberal, progressive person in Israel saying that the same that Spain is doing should happen in Israel. And I know there's a lot of political issues related to the law of return. But have you heard of any developments in trying to... I know that there's groups, I was even contacted by one, that they do conversions for descendants of the Anosim or conversos. But is there any representative or advocate for the people who find out about their heritage? I know Dale Sanchez cut a deal with someone in the Negev to just have a center. I know, but what have you heard? And if you can explain to our audience how the law of return works. I know it's complicated, but just that's one of the first things that people bring up. It's like, oh, well, I can move to Israel. It's like, let's talk about that.
Talk about problems. Where does one begin? The original right of return was set up for the Russian Jews, and you had to have a Jewish grandparent at that point. One grandparent had to have been Jewish. And that worked on some levels. It didn't work on other levels. There were people that converted once they were in Israel, but they could return. There were people that came with other religions and stayed that way. It's a really a cause of friction, even today. The other problem was with the Ethiopians. There are still some municipal rabbis in Israel that will not accept Ethiopians, will not marry them, because they're firmly convinced that they're not Jewish. There are court cases around for that. There are other groups in Israel which say they're Jewish, they're not. And that's another problem. It's a huge problem in Israel. I'm not an Israel expert. I did live there for a number of years. But it is a real problem in Israel. And it comes back to the definition of who's a Jew, what's a Jew. And in some cases, it's really hard to figure that out. It's the same kind of diversity problems that are found in other places, but magnified because it's a tiny place and it's fragmented. And everybody has at least two opinions on one thing. And it's a problem that still has to be worked out. And there's still problems in Russian immigrant community, who are no longer immigrants. These people have been there for, like, some cases for two generations now. It's an ongoing problem in the Ethiopian community. It's a problem with groups that say they're Jewish and they're not in Israel. There's a lot of misinformation here. There were some people here doing group conversions and saying, oh, it's fine, you can get a visa to go live in Israel. Can't, and they couldn't. If one is considering that, one really needs to find a mainstream recognized rabbi in any of the mainstream denominations who's conversant with this problem. There are groups in Israel that work with that. It's very hard to get in touch with them. If they think your case is strong, they will perhaps help you. It's a real problem. It's a real problem. But if you think that someone that just walks around doing mass conversions and says, yeah, this is okay for Aliyah, it's not. And it's not something you should face. Don't count all your chickens before they're hatched, I think is a good way of putting it. And I don't want this to be political. These are everyday problems that people have. And there it's magnified just because it's a small place and it's a small population. So small things tend to get magnified in a smaller population. There are problems, but you need to find real people that know what they're doing, that can properly advise in the correct way with the correct procedures. And not just say, yeah, I'm going to do this and go do that. It rarely works out well. Fanatics or fanatics?
What's the link that you have
This is the link for the Avoteno Jewish Heritage Project, the DNA Project. The website is jewishdna.org, and you can learn all about the project on there. You can click join. The email to contact someone there is Avoteno, AVOTAYNUDNA @gmail.com. It's always worth contacting Adam Brown, who's the managing person for the project, and asking him if he has your names in the file already. If you've already done testing somewhere, let him know. Generally, they need to do the Y-DNA, because that's the direct father to son to son to son to son. Because literally it goes back thousands of years. And autosomal only goes back, depending on the company, 5 to 6, 8 generations. So it's limited in how far back it can go for information. So most of the major projects like this, the academic DNA projects are done on the Y-DNA, the direct male line. So that's the one that I wanted to make sure that people have. And I can also give them our email for Casa Sefarad in Albuquerque. It's Casa, C-A-S-A, Sefarad, S-E, F as in Frank, A-R-A-D-A-B-Q @gmail.com. ABQ, of course, is the airport code for Albuquerque. So it's kasaseferadabq@gmail.com. And we're hoping to get our Facebook page and website and all kinds of things set up. But to be added to the email list for all the future developments and events, if you email us at that email, we'll be happy to add you to the database.
And for those that don't know, Kohen or Kohanim are the priests from the line of Aaron. And then the Levites are like brothers?
The
like
helpers.
The helpers. And then the Israelites are the rest of the Jewish community.
Right.
We mentioned that earlier. So I want to thank you so much for all your wisdom. Maybe you can come back and share more of your experiences. How many countries have you traveled? How many communities have you met who have experienced or found out about their ancestry from the a Jewish background so far?
My family and I, we've lived in Israel, we've lived in Iran. And we had our own group of conversos in Iran, the Jews of Mashhad, that were forcibly converted around 1837, but who lived fully as very observant Jews, underground, totally in secret, until almost 100 years later when they moved to Tehran and they moved around the world. So we had our own group there, which was interesting for me. But in Israel, I saw groups that had these problems. I think my closest experience with this really has been in New Mexico, because we've been there for 10 years, and I have seen all this stuff. Stan Hortus, who wrote, he did most of the amazing work on the Jews of New Mexico, the conversos, the descendants of New Mexico. The book is To the End of the Earth, by Dr. Stanley Hordes, H-O-R-D-E-S. And I've known Stanley forever, a long time, 20 years at least. The book is wonderful. It explains a lot about New Mexico and the families, the original families. But it's not just limited to New Mexico. This phenomenon is all over. It's in Central America, South America. It's in Spain. It's in Portugal today. It's in places all around the world. When people went through traumatic experiences, they generally clammed up about it and they stayed silent in a strange way of trying to protect their children against outside influences or problems or being identified. One of the problems we had in New Mexico, it's a big military state. Many people go to the army, armed services, all branches. And we know that many of the boys that had gone during the Second World War had liberated the concentration camps. They walked in there and they knew what they were seeing. And they came back and they told their families, it's a good thing we're still hiding here. So we lost another two generations. It is now their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren who have the advantage of the internet, where they can search for information and get answers to questions. So we feel that it's changing now. But I think the guys had the right idea when they came back. And they said, it's a good thing we're still hiding. That's traumatic. I mean, I know people that were in the armed services, liberated camps when they died. Some of those who they liberated came back for the funerals. That's a traumatic experience, just like the Inquisition. People in New Mexico are still living through the trauma of the Inquisition. The stories that are told in families are sometimes really horrific. And that brings in the whole new sociological, psychological, genealogical topic of epigenetics, which may be a good one for a future, where experiences that you have lived through literally change your DNA. And it's a very interesting, and now it's really beginning to be accepted by many people. And trauma that has been inflicted on someone, on an ancestor, will work its way through. There are a lot of studies that are being done on people that have lived through trauma or had ancestors with trauma and how things actually affect them today. And scientifically, it's been proven that it does. But it's a really up-and-coming field, epigenetics. How past experiences change one's physical, mental DNA profile.
Again, thank you for your time and for your wisdom, and we hope that you could be a friend of the show and come back and give us updates.
Thank you for listening. We will be back next week with another episode of The Mystic and the Skeptic.